My general meaning, touching the three virtues of which I have spoken, will now, I hope, be sufficiently clear. They are all three paradoxical, they are all three practical, and they are all three paradoxical because they are practical. It is the stress of ultimate need and a terrible knowledge of things as they are which led men to set up these riddles and to die for them. Whatever may be the meaning of the contradiction, it is the fact that the only kind of hope that is of any use in a battle is a hope that denies arithmetic. Whatever may be the meaning of the contradiction, it is the fact that the only kind of charity which any weak spirit wants, or which any generous spirit feels, is the charity which forgives the sins that are like scarlet. Whatever may be the meaning of faith, it must always mean a certainty about something we cannot prove. Thus, for instance, we believe by faith in the existence of other people. But there is another Christian virtue, a virtue far more obviously and historically connected with Christianity, which will illustrate even better the connection between paradox and practical necessity. This virtue cannot be questioned in its capacity as a historical symbol. Certainly, Mr. Lowes Dickinson will not question it. It has been the boast of hundreds of the champions of Christianity. It has been the taunt of hundreds of the opponents of Christianity. It is, in essence, the basis of Mr. Lowes Dickinson's whole distinction between Christianity and paganism. I mean, of course, the virtue of humility. I admit, of course, most readily that a great deal of false Eastern humility, that is, of strictly ascetic humility, mixed itself with the mainstream of European Christianity. We must not forget that when we speak of Christianity, we are speaking of a whole continent for about 1,000 years. But of this virtue, even more than of the other three, I would maintain the general proposition adopted above. Civilization discovered Christian humility for the same urgent reason that it discovered faith and charity. That is, because Christian civilization had to discover it or die. The great psychological discovery of paganism, which turned it into Christianity, can be expressed with some accuracy in one phrase. The pagan set out with admirable sense to enjoy himself. By the end of his civilization, he had discovered that a man cannot enjoy himself and continue to enjoy anything else. Mr. Lowes Dickinson has pointed out in words too excellent to need any further elucidation the absurd shallowness of those who imagine that the pagan enjoyed himself only in a materialistic sense. Of course, he enjoyed himself, not only intellectually even, he enjoyed himself morally, he enjoyed himself spiritually. But it was himself that he was enjoying, on the face of it, a very natural thing to do. Now, the psychological discovery is merely this, that whereas it had been supposed that the fullest possible enjoyment is to be found by extending our ego to infinity, the truth is that the fullest possible enjoyment is to be found by reducing our ego to zero. Humility is the thing which is forever renewing the earth and the stars. It is humility and not duty which preserves the stars from wrong, from the unpardonable wrong of casual resignation. It is through humility that the most ancient heavens for us are fresh and strong. The curse that came before history has laid on us all a tendency to be weary of wonders. If we saw the sun for the first time, it would be the most fearful and beautiful of meteors. Now that we see it for the 100th time, we call it, in the hideous and blasphemous phrase of Wordsworth, the light of common day. We are inclined to increase our claims. We are inclined to demand 6 suns, to demand a blue sun, to demand a green sun. Humility is perpetually putting us back in the primal darkness. There, all light is lightning, startling and instantaneous. Until we understand that original dark in which we have neither sight nor expectation, we can give no hearty and childlike praise to the splendid sensationalism of things. The terms pessimism and optimism, like most modern terms, are unmeaning. But if they can be used in any vague sense as meaning something, we may say that in this great fact, pessimism is the very basis of optimism. The man who destroys himself creates the universe. To the humble man and to the humble man alone, the sun is really a sun. To the humble man and to the humble man alone, the sea is really a sea. When he looks at all the faces in the street, he does not only realize that men are alive, he realizes with a dramatic pleasure that they are not dead. I have not spoken of another aspect of the discovery of humility as a psychological necessity, because it is more commonly insisted on and is in itself more obvious. But it is equally clear that humility is a permanent necessity as a condition of effort and self-examination. It is one of the deadly fallacies of jingo politics that a nation is stronger for despising other nations. As a matter of fact, the strongest nations are those, like Prussia or Japan, which began from very mean beginnings, but have not been too proud to sit at the feet of the foreigner and learn everything from him. Almost every obvious and direct victory has been the victory of the plagiarist. That is, indeed, only a very paltry byproduct of humility, but it is a product of humility, and therefore it is successful. Prussia had no Christian humility in its internal arrangements, hence its internal arrangements were miserable. But it had enough Christian humility slavishly to copy France, even down to Frederick the Great's poetry, and that which it had the humility to copy, it had ultimately the honor to conquer. The case of the Japanese is even more obvious. Their only Christian and their only beautiful quality is that they have humbled themselves to be exalted. All this aspect of humility, however, as connected with the matter of effort and striving for a standard set above us, I dismiss as having been sufficiently pointed out by almost all idealistic writers. It may be worthwhile, however, to point out the interesting disparity in the matter of humility between the modern notion of the strong man and the actual records of strong men. Carlyle objected to the statement that no man could be a hero to his valet. Every sympathy can be extended towards him in the matter if he merely or mainly meant that the phrase was a disparagement of hero worship. Hero worship is certainly a generous and human impulse. The hero may be faulty, but the worship can hardly be. It may be that no man would be a hero to his valet, but any man would be a valet to his hero. But in truth, both the proverb itself and Carlyle's stricture upon it ignore the most essential matter at issue. The ultimate psychological truth is not that no man is a hero to his valet. The ultimate psychological truth, the foundation of Christianity, is that no man is a hero to himself. Cromwell, according to Carlyle, was a strong man. According to Cromwell, he was a weak one. The weak point in the whole of Carlyle's case for aristocracy lies, indeed, in his most celebrated phrase. Carlyle said that men were mostly fools. Christianity, with a surer and more reverent realism, says that they are all fools. This doctrine is sometimes called the doctrine of original sin. It may also be described as the doctrine of the equality of men. But the essential point of it is merely this, that whatever primary and far-reaching moral dangers affect any man, affect all men. All men can be criminals. If tempted, all men can be heroes, if inspired. And this doctrine does away altogether with Carlyle's pathetic belief, or anyone else's pathetic belief, in the wise few. There are no wise few. Every aristocracy that has ever existed has behaved in all essential points exactly like a small mob. Every oligarchy is merely a knot of men in the street. That is to say, it is very jolly, but not infallible. And no oligarchies in the world's history have ever come off so badly in practical affairs as the very proud oligarchies. The oligarchy of Poland, the oligarchy of Venice, and the armies that have most swiftly and suddenly broke their enemies in pieces have been the religious armies, the Muslim armies, for instance, or the Puritan armies. And a religious army may, by its nature, be defined as an army in which every man is taught not to exalt, but to abase himself. Many modern Englishmen talk of themselves as the sturdy descendants of their sturdy Puritan fathers. As a fact, they would run away from a cow. If you asked one of their Puritan fathers, if you asked Bunyan, for instance, whether he was sturdy, he would have answered with tears that he was as weak as water. And because of this, he would have borne tortures. And this virtue of humility, while being practical enough to win battles, will always be paradoxical enough to puzzle pedants. It is at one with the virtue of charity in this respect. Every generous person will admit that the one kind of sin which charity should cover is a sin which is inexcusable. And every generous person will equally agree that the one kind of pride which is wholly damnable is the pride of the man who has something to be proud of. The pride which, proportionally speaking, does not hurt the character is the pride in things which reflect no credit on the person at all. Thus it does a man no harm to be proud of his country, and comparatively little harm to be proud of his remote ancestors. It does him more harm to be proud of having made money, because in that he has a little more reason for pride. It does him more harm still to be proud of what is nobler than money, intellect, and it does him most harm of all to value himself for the most valuable thing on earth, goodness. The man who is proud of what is really credible to him is the Pharisee, the man whom Christ himself could not forbear to strike. My objection to Mr. Lowes Dickinson and the reasserters of the pagan ideal is, then, this. I accuse them of ignoring definite human discoveries in the moral world, discoveries as definite, though not as material, as the discovery of the circulation of the blood. We cannot go back to an ideal of reason and sanity, for mankind has discovered that reason does not lead to sanity. We cannot go back to an ideal of pride and enjoyment, for mankind has discovered that pride does not lead to enjoyment. I do not know by what extraordinary mental accident modern writers so constantly connect the idea of progress with the idea of independent thinking. Progress is obviously the antithesis of independent thinking. For under independent or individualistic thinking, every man starts at the beginning and goes in all probability just as far as his father before him. But if there really be anything of the nature of progress, it must mean, above all things, the careful study and assumption of the whole of the past. I accuse Mr. Lowes Dickinson and his school of reaction in the only real sense. If he likes, let him ignore these great historic mysteries, the mystery of charity, the mystery of chivalry, the mystery of faith. If he likes, let him ignore the plow or the printing press. But if we do revive and pursue the pagan ideal of a simple and rational self-completion, we shall end where paganism ended. I do not mean that we shall end in destruction. I mean that we shall end in Christianity.